So I want to tell you about the moments that I think you need to see and that you need to know about on this day, because they're important. First of all, the EU is telling Russia, we're not going to move anybody from Kiev. It's like, do they want a war? Is that what this is about? Netanyahu has gotten his way. The ceasefire is off, the war is back on, and they're going into Lebanon. And then what do you do with a dead Nazi? I know it's an interesting question, right? The answer is going to shock you, or maybe not. This is the Sanchez effect. We're going to be talking to a member of the EU who's being shunned. Why do you think he's being shunned? We're going to ask him. He's going to tell us. Let's do this. Hello again, everybody. I'm Rick Sanchez, and I want to thank you for being there with us, because it means a lot to us, you know? We depend on you. Well, war's back on. The U.S. is bombing Iran again, under orders from Bibi Netanyahu. If that sounds like a crack on my part, it's not. It's what's actually taking place right now. The U.S. is doing what Israel wants. Maybe I should say what Israel demands. Think about this pattern, right? Think about this pattern. Israel wanted the United States to attack Iraq, and it happened. They wanted the United States to attack Syria. Boom, it happened. They wanted the United States to attack Libya. Boom, it happened. They wanted the United States to fund the slaughter of Palestinians. So we sent them the weapons, sent them the money so that they can do so. And now they're saying, keep on bombing Iran. Whatever you do, keep on bombing Iran. So last night, the U.S. kept on bombing Iran again. Here's the headline. Let me show it to you. This is on state TV. This is CNN, one of the networks that provides cover and propaganda for the U.S. war machine enterprise. And as you can see, what it says, what's it say right there? See it? It says the U.S. targeted Iranian missile launch sites in, quote, self-defense. Keyword, self-defense. Gee, I wonder who gave Mr. Trump or the U.S. Officials that excuse, right? Where have I heard that before? Which country can you think of that has made a pattern of starting wars, attacking and killing Muslims everywhere, and then pronouncing its victimhood and saying it's self-defense? Got to do it. You get three guesses. First two don't count. You're right. Israel. That's who does that. That's the pattern. That's their pattern. And here's the funny thing, you know? I started preparing this broadcast last night. At the time when I was sitting at home thinking, you know, what do I want to say tomorrow? What do I want to talk about, right? The headline that was being shared all over the world was this. Look at this headline. This is the headline, right? Bibi's hair is on fire. Benjamin Netanyahu is so upset that his hair is on fire. And the story also said that Mr. Trump and Mr. Netanyahu are feuding, they're fighting, you know, they're angry at each other. That story was put out by the state media outlets in the United States and in Europe. And none of them seemed to question it. They just, you know, they're stenographers, right? Well, you know who did question it? I did. In fact, I just looked at my notes from last night. I was preparing an analysis for you today, you know, where I open the show, what I say. And I was going to tell you that I smelled a ruse. I smelled a rat, or a rat with a ruse, whatever, right? Is it a ruse or a rat? My thinking was, if they claim that Netanyahu and Trump are having an argument about the war, then Iran should immediately see that and say, okay, we're about to get bombed again. That's the pattern. Because, look, two things can happen. Either it really is an argument, which I don't think it was, or... And even if it were an argument, right? Netanyahu's Trump's boss. So if there's an argument between those two guys, who wins? Of course, Netanyahu wins. And what just happened? Just as I called it, or would have, true to form, there was an attack on Iran. You don't have to be a genius to figure this stuff out. You just gotta, all you gotta do is pay attention, right? State TV in the West, meanwhile, they report with unquestioned loyalty to the war machine and to Israel. Let me give you an example of where they could ask questions, but they don't. Here's Marco Rubio. He's on a plane. This happened in the last 24 hours. And he's talking about the regime. The regime. The regime in Tehran. And he's talking about how dare they close the Strait of Hormuz. Here, listen.
States have to be open. They're going to be open one way or the other. So they need to be open. What's happening there is unlawful. It's illegal. It's unsustainable for the world. It's unacceptable. I don't know of any country in the world that does it. The Russians are not in favor of a tolling system. The Chinese are not in favor of a tolling system. I mean, there's no country in the world that's in favor of a tolling system except the regime in Iran. So that's not acceptable. That cannot happen.
You know, there's an obvious counterpoint to this, right? Did you hear what he said? And the obvious counterpoint screams, right? It screams to be asked, right? And it's this. But wait, Mr. Secretary, with all due respect, wasn't the Strait of Hormuz open and working perfectly well before you, sir, attacked Iran? Didn't you, in essence, then close the Strait of Hormuz by starting this war? I mean, you bombed neighborhoods. You assassinated the leaders of the country. You killed their most revered religious figure. You killed 100 little girls in a school. You killed their negotiators that were talking to you. You killed their families as well. And now you argue they aren't playing fair. They're not being nice. It's crazy. It's freaking crazy. If that doesn't sound crazy to you, I'll tell you, it certainly sounds crazy to me. It's almost like I break into your house, right? You, listening to me, right? I, Rick Sanchez, go to your house, and I kill your family, and I'm your next-door neighbor, right? And then you get mad. You get mad, or I get mad at you, pardon me, because I won't let you, you won't let me go into the backyard and pick flowers anymore. I killed your family, and now I'm mad at you because you're not letting me go to your backyard and pick mangoes or flowers or something. You got to be a psychopath to say something like this, right? But CNN... Fox, CBS, BBC. See, to all of them, this is perfectly normal. To them, the United States and Israel, the attackers, they're the ones who are simply defending themselves, self-defense. Iran, on the other hand, the country that was attacked, right? Oh, and by the way, we still don't know why the hell they were attacked. They're the bad guys. They're the aggressors. I want to tell you something that's going on right now because there seems to be more on that breaking news that we had heard about. It appears at this point. Remember I told you just a little while ago about who was going to win this argument? It's not like I'm prescient or anything like that. It's not like I'm all that smart. You just got to follow the pattern here. I said if there's an argument as to whether this war would continue between Trump and Netanyahu, Netanyahu will win that argument 99.9% of the time. In fact, the Iranians had been telling the U.S. in their negotiations, if we do a ceasefire or if we stop this war, there's a condition that we need. It can't just be stopping your attacks on Iran. You also have to get Israel to stop its attacks on Lebanon. That was going to be part of the deal. That's what they were hoping to be able to get. And if they got that, there's a possibility tonight I would be telling you that the war is over. Well, guess what? The war's not over. The United States just hit Iran, and now we understand Israel is sending its troops back into Lebanon. Yeah, boots on the ground in Lebanon. Israeli soldiers are in Lebanon. As a matter of fact, as we report this, we've got Ali Rides Baeti. He's an RT correspondent. He's standing by there to let us know what the hell's going on. I'm just thinking, Ali, this is so true to form. I kind of called it last night, and I hate to say this. I wish I'd been wrong, but it's happening just as it seemed Israel wanted it to happen. What do you know? What can you tell us about this assault on Lebanon? Please, fill us in.
Hello, Rick, and to all our viewers. First of all, it was very expected because whenever the negotiations between the United States and Iran comes into a better position, we always know that Netanyahu is going to do something to break this negotiations. And he's using the fields in Lebanon and the Lebanese territories to break these negotiations between the two countries, between Iran and the United States. So we were expecting that. And it wasn't long after, later last night, we started hearing the news about the escalation of the war in Lebanon, because even though it wasn't so still or so calm, especially in South Lebanon, it's been calm in Beirut. No attacks, only 2 weeks ago, the assassination in Har Tehreek, but it is very intense for the people here. The people haven't gone back to Dahi because they can't feel safe there because of the sudden attacks of the Israeli army that what's happening in Beirut, especially. It's not been a month ago that we've seen the what we call here in Lebanon the Black Wednesday, when they carried out more than 160 airstrikes in 10 minutes, leaving more than 300 killed and 1,200 wounded. So people they can't feel safe to go back to the southern suburbs because it came under a lot of attacks during the escalation and even that assassination in Har Tahrir. So we've heard on the news that they are escalating the war and they will carry more attacks and wider attacks because now the attacks are in South Lebanon mainly and in Bitar, mainly areas that are fled out of people, even though they are targeting civilians. Yesterday we've seen 11 civilians killed in Mashghara and West Bitar.
So let me stop you real quick because I want to get a better understanding of what actually just changed. And I thank you for giving us the background on this because it's very cogent and very important. But is Israel now actually doing a ground assault into southern Lebanon? And why is that new? And let me just ask you a second question on that as a follow-up. What do we expect that the Lebanese will do, Hezbollah will do, to counter that?
To be honest, it's not the first time that the Israeli troops are inside Lebanon. They are inside Lebanon now, and we've seen it by the Hezbollah announcement every day that they are targeting the Israeli troops inside Lebanese territories in Bayada, in Bint Jbeil, and around the southern Lebanese villages. So they are already there, working there. But maybe what this means that they want to get more troops and more ground troops inside Lebanese territories because of the multiple attacks by Hezbollah on the ground. They are facing more casualties to their vehicles, to their troops on the ground. Mm-hmm. So maybe they want to get more troops on the ground to sustain the situation better. But this is very hard for them to sustain the situation because the geographic pattern for South Lebanon is very hard for any military service to work in it. And for Hezbollah, they know the ground, they know the mountains, the hills, the valleys. They memorize every inch of it, and they know where and what they are dealing with. And especially now with these FPV drones that they are using now during this escalation in Lebanon, it's giving a very hard time for the Israeli army to work with it, because whenever they take any measurement, they added the nets over the troops and the vehicles, even though the operators of Hezbollah maneuver below these nets and still target the troops. So it's very hard for them. Maybe they think that if we added more troops to the ground, it will be easier for us to work there.
It sounds like you're almost describing parts of Ukraine right now. You know, and a final question for you, by the way, for those of you now joining us, we're following breaking news, the reporting coming out of Israel, interestingly enough. From the Israel press is that Israeli troops are marching in on Lebanon once again. It sounds like a almost a full force maneuver, and we're learning from our correspondent Ali, who's telling us that the Hezbollah troops are ready for them. So this is going to escalate once again. So this is a big deal for Iran. Iran is saying this is a part of what we will just not accept. Right? It's not just about stopping the war; it's about stopping Israel. What do you expect Iran might do? I mean, I know Iran already supports Hezbollah in some ways. That's something we understand. Mm-hmm. But will they make this part of the new front in this war against Israel, do you think, Ali?
Iran, yesterday we saw an announcement by Iranian officials that if any attacks happen to Beirut or the southern suburbs, they will not stand aside and just let it slide. So Iran might just do any retaliation attack or do any sudden attacks just to say that we are serious about this. I know we've heard this many times before that any escalation.
You mean attack? You mean attack on Syria? Syria.
and Israel.
You mean attack on Israel, right? You mean Iran?
Yeah, they said that. They announced that. the kind of the attack or the shape of the attack, no one can know, because we've heard this announcement a few times, especially when the negotiation started, and Iran is always saying that Lebanon is part of this negotiation and we will not get along with it until the war in Lebanon is done and is ended for good.
Yeah.
So the last announcement yesterday, it came after the announcement by the Israeli officials and by Benjamin Netanyahu, who said that they will escalate the war. And they said as if they were going to bomb Beirut. And we've seen actually people fleeing the southern suburbs. The few families who were still staying there because they have no other shelter, they left the southern suburbs for more safer areas. And then we heard the Iranian announcement. But the least we know that the Strait of Hormuz is going to still be used to get a better position for Lebanon, even though the Lebanese government is doing a very good job, to be honest.
Yeah.
Since the first time when we heard by the Pakistani officials that the negotiations between Iran and the United States have Lebanon as a major part of it,
yeah,
the Lebanese official and the prime minister said that Lebanon is only the government negotiate about Lebanon, and they gave a green light to the Israeli army to escalate more and to carry those attacks. So Hezbollah is stick with the Iranian position, and they say that whenever this negotiation, direct negotiation between Lebanon and the Israel goes, they will never stop fighting until the last Israeli soldier gets out of the southern Lebanese.
I get your point. And to be fair, I mean, it's not only Israel that's being headstrong about this. It's also, the Lebanese when it comes to the fighting. It just looks like with your report and with what we just said, the takeaway here is if you expected that we would be close to a ceasefire or that it would last, or that we were getting close to some kind of deal or some kind of truce that was going to end the fighting between the United States, Israel, and Iran, you guessed wrong. This thing is now hot and heavy once again, and it's going to continue for some time. Ali Rita Zbaiti, thank you so much for joining us and for giving us your perspective on this breaking news as it's coming in. We certainly appreciate it. So I'm going to show you another headline now, and this one actually gets it right. So props to Al Jazeera. It says, Russia warns foreigners to leave Kiev as it prepares systematic strikes. Now, and look at the subheadline. This is interesting. You see this right here? Moscow calls upcoming systematic strikes on Ukrainian capital a response to Kiev's recent attack on Luhansk. That's correct, by the way. That's actually what happened. Certainly a lot better of a headline than the ones that we've been seeing in the BBC, for example, that have failed to mention the bombing of a school in Luhansk, other than to say that the Russians claim that Ukraine did that. Claim, as if somehow it's in doubt. Like, who else would have done it? The Russians killed their own people? Sure, why not? They've said that before. So, no. Russia is not claiming anything. Russia is not claiming that Ukraine attacked the campus and the village that surrounds it. That actually happened, okay? I know because I was there, right? And let me tell you something else that you need to know right now, something else that you will never see reported or even provided as a fair analysis by the state TV networks in the United States or in the West, right? And here it is. So let me tell you what this really means. When Russia, as you saw in that report, which is correct, Russia has given fair warning to the United States to get its people out of Kiev because Russia's saying, we're going to hit Kiev and we're going to hit the government installations. So what do you think they mean when they say the people? Do you think the Russians are telling the Americans to tell the Smith family visiting from Kansas on their annual holiday to Ukraine to get out? Do you think they're talking about tourists from Europe? You think they're talking about maybe backpackers from Germany or from Canada who are there backpacking to the outskirts of Kiev? No. Do you know what Mr. Lavrov is telling the United States to do, really? What he's telling them is get the CIA agents, right, out. The special ops people we know you have there, right? The undercover folks that we know you have there. Yeah, get your people out means get your military personnel who we know are there and have been helping in the guiding, telling the Ukrainians how to attack us and guiding their missiles that have been hitting our civilians. That's what he's saying, you know? And what he's also saying is, please do that. That way you can't say later on CNN or on Fox the next day that Russia attacked and killed a U.S. soldier who happened to be there, even though they'll probably, you know, report that anyway on CNN or on Fox, right? And they'll also say that the attack came, of course, without any fair warning. You want an example of what I'm talking about, as a matter of fact? Look at the reaction so far on this story from the EU's Kaya Kallas, or France's Emmanuel Macron, to Russia's retaliatory strike on Kyiv. I mean, so listen, here, follow this. Kyiv, right, bombs a school in the middle of the night and kills and maims students. Russia reacts by firing missiles into Kyiv, according to reports, 4 people were killed. Those are the facts. But look at what Kaya Kallas writes on X. Watch, listen.
Russia hit a dead end on the battlefield, so it terrorizes Ukraine with deliberate strikes on city centers. These are abhorrent acts of terror meant to kill as many civilians as possible.
These two people, you're seeing right there, lovely couple, by the way, right? Who most Europeans, by the way, they don't like these two people. They don't trust these two people. These two people never had the decency to pick up the phone and offer condolences for the death of these students, right? They could have called Russia. Okay, you don't like Putin, you don't want to call him, fine, don't call him. Call the community. Send some kind of send a letter to the people who live there, the parents who lost these 21 kids, right? That would have been the decent thing to do, no? But when Russia retaliates and kills 4 people, they go after Russia with a vengeance. And by the way, they never once mention when they go after Russia the reason why Russia did this. Instead, they say that it means that Russia's losing the war, which is crazy when you consider that Russia now controls 100% of Luhansk, you know? And every single person I talked to there, you may have seen it when I went around talking to these people. They told me, look, we don't want to be a part of Ukraine. They told me they're delighted to be a part of Russia. So who are you going to trust? I'm asking. The people who live there, who I talked to, or Macron and Kaya Kallas? Time for our reality check now. And we're going to do our reality check on Europe, the place where Nazism emanated from. Some would say it's still alive and well there, as a matter of fact, especially when it comes to Europe's relationship with Ukraine. Proof: Ukraine is still honoring Nazis. In fact, they just did it again. Che Boz just sent this report to us. Here, take a listen.
Hey, Rick, can't be with you today in person, but I've got a cracking story for you. You might remember back in 2023, a man called Yaroslav Hunka. Let's have a look at him. He was then a 98-year-old Ukrainian military veteran as he was presented to the Canadian Parliament. The Canadian Parliament gives this guy 2 standing ovations. Yeah, 2. Zelensky is there. Canadian Prime Minister is there. They're all clapping. They're all cheering this guy. Problem: he turned out to be an SS veteran. That's right, the SS, the 14th Galician SS, which was an exclusively Ukrainian SS brigade battalion that fought for the Nazis in the Second World War. That's bad, right? Very, very bad. A man cheered in the Canadian Parliament who fought with the military wing of the Nazi Party. Yeah, that's bad. But it gets much, much worse. It turns out that Hunka was part of a group of 8,000 SS men. That's right, check it out, who were part of a thing called the Rimini List. 8,000 SS veterans were moved from their camp in Rimini in Italy into the United Kingdom and Canada. Why is this all relevant? Well, only days ago, another Ukrainian Nazi called Andrei Melnik was exhumed in Luxembourg, in Europe. Check out Luxembourg on the map. Very small, very, very wealthy, influential European country. They exhumed this guy called Andrei Melnik, who again was aligned with the Nazis in the Second World War, fighting for radical Ukrainian, let's say, militants during the Second World War with the Nazis, and he was brought back to Kiev. And check it out, he got a military funeral with all of these honors. So when you hear about this no Nazis in Ukraine, you got to ask yourselves, what's the facts behind the reality? And the facts behind the reality are that there's a long and very dark association in the West with Ukrainian Nazis in particular. And the fact that a European country right now sees fit to exhume the bones of a known Nazi and his wife, bring them back to Ukraine to be buried as heroes, it tells us a hell of a lot. What do you think?
Yeah, it's fascinating stuff. Thanks so much. And usually he's going to be joining us here on set. He happened to be traveling away. He had to send us that report this time. All right, joining us now to talk about this and other stories is Fernand Kartheiser. Mr. Kartheiser is a member of the European Union. He was elected in 2024. But let me tell you why I wanted to have him on the show. Let me tell you why we reached out to him, because he's in the news right now. Yeah, that non-conspicuous-looking man you see right there is actually very, very controversial. And the reason he's controversial and the reason he's got that sneaky smile on his face right now is because he actually wanted to bring Europeans to St. Petersburg so they can meet Russians, talk to Russians, and see and ask questions about the Russian economy and what's going on with it. He wanted to bring them to the Economic Forum at St. Petersburg that's coming up in just a few weeks. And for suggesting that he wanted to do that, he is now persona non grata in the European Union. Wow. Did I get that right?
Well, first of all, hello and thank you. thank you for having me on the show. I'm very, very happy to be here to discuss with you, Rick, on a number of matters. And actually, I'm in the news for more than a year already now, because I went to Moscow in May 25, in order to try to establish a dialogue with the Russian Federation in spite of the official difficult situation.
So wait. You wanted to talk to Russians? Don't you know you're not supposed, you're European, you're supposed to hate Russians. You're not allowed to talk to them or create conversations with them. In fact, you could end up in jail for doing something like that nowadays, I understand, in Europe. Isn't that true?
Well, I hope not in jail, but I went to Moscow, and of course I speak to Russians because Russians are as European as we in the European Union are European. So I must say we share this continent, and so I think it's very normal to talk to our neighbors. And so I went there, and together with Mr. Slutsky from the State Duma, it was possible to establish such a dialogue, and we have met already several times by video conferences in person. And our next meeting will be, as you said, Rick, in St. Petersburg on the 3rd of June. So, yes, this is, of course, in the news again, but this is not a problem for me, because I know that many, many people in the European Union think exactly in the same way as you and I do. We think that dialogue is absolutely normal, it is necessary, it is the only way to build a future together, to come to reason again and to build something positive, to try to resolve our problems. So dialogue is what we should do, and I'm really astonished that we have still politicians such as Mrs. Kallas, for instance, who has not realized this, and they are actually more of a danger to Europe than you and I would be.
Well, I'll tell you this, if it's any recourse to you, I'm going to be there in Spiff, and I will meet with you, and I will have I will buy you a cup of coffee, okay? Just wanted you to give you the good news.
Yes, with pleasure. If I can also buy a cup of coffee to you, a cappuccino or whatever, something very European.
it'll be Cuban coffee for me. Let me ask you this follow-up question, because I think this is a good question that, you know, we've got tens of millions of people who are going to be watching this conversation that you and I are having. And I bet you that millions of them are thinking this themselves, because it came to me as I was listening to you. What are they afraid of? What could possibly be so scary about talking to a Russian? Even if you don't like Russians, even if you hate Putin, whatever, what is so scary about talking to a Russian that they're so mad at you for even suggesting you want to do that?
Well, you know, I think that the politics in Western Europe has become a prisoner of its own narratives, actually. There is no real logical reason for what the European foreign policy is doing. I think it's a result of a wrong strategic decision that has been taken years ago when the Biden administration in the United States wanted actually to this war in Ukraine and has done a lot together with Boris Johnson from the United Kingdom to keep it going, even when Russia and Ukraine had initialed already an agreement among themselves in order in April 22 in order to settle or at least to try to start negotiations to find a peaceful solution. Then the West intervened. Boris Johnson on April 9, 22 came to Kiev and he said, no, continue fighting. So at that moment, I think the United States, Biden administration and the European Union, together with the United Kingdom, they took these political decisions. They initialed also the sanctions, and the sanctions are going on and becoming heavier and heavier. So, and they cannot find a way out of this political decision that they have taken years ago, even though the United States have changed. The Trump administration says it's Biden's war in order to have a certain distance. They don't want to take the responsibility fully because they say it's the former president who took the responsibility. But for the Europeans, they never changed. They just keep on with these policies. And they can't find a way out because they have no agreement among themselves. You have in the European Union a number of member states who are vehemently opposed to Russia, very aggressively, and you have those who would like to have a dialogue and change policies. But since we have this European common foreign policy and a lot of pressure on all the countries, we are simply in deadlock right now. And I think that it might come at a certain point also to a breaking point maybe in this common foreign and security policy, because we are just in a situation where no other region in the world is in. All the other regions in the world, including the Americans, including even Ukrainians in some talks, have contacts with the Russian Federation, except European Union, except your neighbors. And the neighbors talk to it, do not talk to each other, so it's absolutely not acceptable.
I wonder if it's just greed. It's like, how badly do they want Ukraine to be a part of Europe? They want it so. And I'll tell you what I think. I was just there. I don't know if you saw my reporting, but I just got back within the last 24 hours from the Donbas. I'd never been there before. I've always wanted to see the Donbas. So I got to tell you, fascinating place. It's like, first of all, Ardent Hills, magnificently beautiful. The roads are pristine. It's a cool place. I could see where this place could become the breadbasket of the world. Iron ore, steel production, rare earth. I can see why the Europeans and the Americans want this place. And it seems to me the Russians were willing at one time to let it just be neutral, but the Europeans didn't want it to be neutral. They wanted it for themselves. And that's really, I think, after my visit yesterday, I get a sense that's the real reason they want this war to continue and why they want you to not talk to the Russians, because you're getting in the way of what they desire most, and that is that region. I think. Am I wrong?
Well, I think that there's a lot of truth in what you are saying, because if I remember correctly, we had, even before Maidan, before 2014, 2013, we had these discussions about the association agreement between the European Union and Ukraine in those days. And of course, this created problems in Ukraine, because a lot of the economy in Ukraine, especially in the Donbas, was still oriented and integrated, actually, in the former economic area of the Soviet Union. Mm. For instance, industrial norms. And so if the Western orientation of Ukraine would have been too fast, this would also have meant that a lot of the industrial tissue in the Donbas would have been destroyed, with a lot of economic consequences, unemployment potentially, and so on. And of course, we had also problems with Russia already in those days, because the Russians and Ukraine had a free trade area. And we wanted to establish one also with Ukraine. And so there was clearly a competition between European ideas on free trade and the Russian ideas on free trade. So, yes, there were a lot of economic interests. And actually, there was a lot of pushing from the European Union also to integrate Ukraine into the West. But let me say, no, I think that many people would like to have Ukraine in the EU, but many more would not like to have them. The idea, I think the hawks probably would like to have the EU in the Ukraine in the EU as soon as possible. Why? Because we have in the EU In the treaties, we have an article, Article 42.7, which is a solidarity clause, a kind of assistance clause. So if Ukraine would join the European Union, that would mean that we would have to give assistance to Ukraine, and that is just a means to draw the European Union and perhaps also, by extension, the United States directly into the confrontation with Russia. So the hawks in Europe would like to have Ukraine in the European Union. But so many other countries do not want to have that because they know, for instance, for agricultural reasons and for many other reasons, that Ukraine cannot be easily integrated into the Union. And so they are breaking. I do think myself that it will take long, long years in order to admit them. And there are some traditions that we have and some rules. And they are obviously, they are forgotten about for the time being. The first is the treaties say themselves that the country that would like to join the European Union has to fulfill all the criteria, what we call the Copenhagen criteria. Mm-hmm. Ukraine cannot fulfill any of these criteria. So it would be a very long way to go. And the second rule that we had is always that EU enlargement should serve peace in Europe. So we have always demanded of candidate countries to settle their problems with national minorities, to settle their problems with their neighbors before joining the EU. So in those days, the EU was actively a peace force in Europe because we put pressure on candidate countries to settle their disputes with their neighbors and with their national minorities in order to be able to join in a peaceful kind of union of states in Europe. But this is not the case anymore because we are not demanding right now of Ukraine to settle its disputes with its Russian neighbors. And there are not only problems with the Russian-speaking minorities in Ukraine, we have also problems with Hungarian minorities, with Romanian minorities in Ukraine, maybe even with others. I'm not aware of everything in this respect. But just to tell you that if we stick to the traditions of the European Union, I must say we have to fulfill the official criteria, the Copenhagen criteria. And second, Ukraine should settle all its disputes with its neighbors and its national minorities before joining.
You explained that so well. I've never had anybody explain so well the reasons, or as you say, the criteria for why it would make absolutely no sense for EU to give a membership, at least at this particular point in time, to the Ukrainians. And I think I might be able to add another one as to why I think, based on my recent research, why it would be an albatross for the Europeans to take on the debts and the corruption. But something even more, I was just running the numbers, and the number of people population-wise that are living in Ukraine right now is down to about 24 million or something like that. That's pretty small. Supposing it's even 30 million or something like that. It used to be 42 million. Apparently, 12 million of those are seniors, older people who are on pension plans, so they're not paying anything into the system. And another 5 million are children. So essentially, you have a very small base to draw from. Economically, they would be a problem for the EU economically. They'd be an albatross for you. They wouldn't contribute, especially without Crimea and without the Donbass, and without Aparecia and Kherson. This would be a very small country with not a lot to offer, right?
Rick, I think that's a good description. I think that also when it comes to money, we all know, without maybe telling it openly, so you give me the opportunity to say it openly, we can probably not even afford to accept the Ukraine in the European Union right now, because it's just too expensive. We have already, if you remember, a lot of problems with our farmers who are concerned with issues such as free trade arrangements with other continents and so on, who are very nervous about their income, and I fully understand them, I must say. But you can imagine that a country such as Ukraine, if it joined, would completely change the whole setup of, for instance, the common agricultural policy. Ukraine has an agricultural surface that is as big as, I think, the French and the German agricultural surfaces together. So it would completely change the financing modus of the European Union, the budget of the European Union, and many countries that would be net beneficiaries for the time being of the EU budgets, those who get more money than they pay to the EU, all of them would suddenly become become net contributors. So because Ukraine is so poor, so destroyed, it has no working economy anymore, that all of us in the European Union now, even the weakest, even the poorest of our member states, would become net contributors and would have to help Ukraine to get a new economic opportunity.
So everything you just said makes so much damn sense to me. I mean, I'm not the smartest guy in the world, but I figured that out right away. Why can't Ursula von der Leyen understand this? Why can't Kaya Kallas understand this? And Macron and Starmer and Mertz and Stubb and these guys? Why don't they get that? It's so logical.
Yeah, I think it would be, and I don't think that these people are not able to understand this, but they are, on the one side, prisoners of their own narrative, as we described it before. They always have described Russia as the evil state, having launched an unjustified, unprovoked aggression against Ukraine. It was this one-sided narrative, and they have problems coming out of that story. But in addition, there is a hidden agenda. I mean, we have often seen in history that a country or a group of countries looks for an external enemy, you know, in order to achieve some internal projects. And in this case, the project that they want to achieve is European federalism. They want to create a European state. The European Union should be transformed into a state. And in order to do that, you need a common foreign policy, you need a common budget, you need a common army, you need a common defense structure, and so on and so on. And this is what they are building right now. They are turning an economic union, the European Union, more and more into a political and military union kind of European NATO. And in order to do that, of course, you need an external enemy. The problem is not only that we have, because of that, among others, because of that, quite an aggressive foreign policy, but also we have more and more censorship inside the European Union. We have the Digital Services Act and so on, and we have a democracy shield. And these are legislative acts within the European Union that are more and more restricting the freedom, the democratic freedom, the freedom of speech that we had always enjoyed within our Western European states. So it is a very dangerous evolution that we see now, because the foreign policy might lead to conflict. The aggressive foreign policy that we currently have towards Russia might lead to an open conflict. And in addition, we are losing more and more freedom inside the European Union. So my conclusion is very clear. We have to, if as soon as possible, peace in Ukraine, together with our Russian neighbors, and therefore we have also to have this dialogue, of course, we have to talk to each other.
Right.
Because it's in the interest not only of a common security architecture in Europe, but also it is in the interest of our freedom in Europe, freedom in the East, freedom in the West, in order that people can conserve their fundamental rights and their democracy as we love it.
You sound, again, I know I said this before, and I don't want to sound like a broken record, but you sound so logical. You're making such a perfectly cogent argument that it would be difficult for anyone to deconstruct what you're saying. You're not a crazy guy. You're not a madman. You're saying, yeah, there's some issues with Russia, but let's talk about Russia. Russia's probably more than willing to sit down and, you know, they'll give in on some of the things that, you know, they're going to argue for or argue against. And that's the way you come up with some kind of compromise. And yet, when I did my research on you and I started reading about what people are saying about you, you sound to me like a very logical man who's willing to sit down and have a conversation and come up with a compromise. But they call you right wing. They've thrown you out of the groups that you used to belong to. They've somewhat externalized you. The person I read about when I started reading about you in the Western media is not the person who's talking to me right here. That's got to make you a little bit angry, no?
No, not at all. I think it's funny in a way, you know, because I have been expelled from my political group, the European Conservatives and Reformists and so on, because I went to Moscow and wanted to speak to our Russian neighbors. And now they are looking for somebody, you know, on governmental level. They have exactly what I did a year ago. Now they are looking for potential candidate who would be able to speak to the Russians. You know, they are discussing Macron, Kallas, or maybe even others. I think I read somewhere in Politico that even the Norwegian and the Indian foreign ministers were considered for a time being. And now they are looking for somebody who might speak to the Russians, and they expelled me a year ago for speaking to the Russians. So I think it's quite funny, actually, because I'm old enough to have a certain distance to those things. But seriously speaking, it's not about the candidate. That is not really the most important question, but it's about the mandate. Because it's not enough to send somebody if they find anybody who would like to do that or whom they would trust to do that. That's even more complicated, I think. But let's imagine that they find a person whom they entrust to represent the European Union and to go to Moscow or to meet somewhere with the Russian foreign minister or somebody. Yeah. But what mandate would he have? Because, you know, this narrative that the European Union has is a very clear, one-sided, anti-Russian, you know, the Russians are the evil imperialists, yes. And we are the good ones, and so on. And you cannot negotiate on such a basis. If you want to negotiate, you need a mandate with a certain flexibility.
Yes.
And exactly this flexibility the European Union cannot produce, because if it produces this flexibility, it cannot uphold the narrative. And if it cannot uphold the narrative, it cannot pursue its own project of militarization or federalization. So they cannot negotiate with somebody whom they need to achieve their own goals, which are not really publicized, but which are still there, this kind of militarization, federalization, and so on. So they are in a very difficult situation, and they have no flexibility. I'm really curious to see what is going to happen. But for my person, I can assure you, I'm very happy with what I'm doing, and I have a lot of humor, and I see this situation with the necessary distance.
History will look back at you, I think, and say, that guy was right, and the other folks over there were wrong. At least if you look at the trends of what's going on these days in Europe, and, you know, look, the people of Europe deserve better. They're good people. They're strong people, and... the leaders they have right now, who, by the way, have approval numbers like I've seen 12s and 11s and 15, and it's like, you know, it's incredible. I mean, they hate Putin, but Putin's got like 80% approval in this country. And this is not a poll that was conducted in Russia. It was conducted in Germany. So the whole thing seems like it's on its head. By the way, you said something that I want to come back to. I never heard this before. But you said in many ways that the Europeans were kind of jealous of the free trade relationship that at the time the Russians, prior to 2014, had established with the Ukrainians. In other words, they were willing to do trade deals, and Ukraine and Russia were kind of economically working somewhat cooperatively. And the Europeans, I think I heard you say about 10 minutes ago, were kind of angry about that because they wanted to have this relationship with Ukraine. Talk about that a little bit more, because I've never heard that before.
Well, there was clearly a kind of competition. I think that we were aware at these times when we established this free trade relation with the Donbas, with Ukraine, and, mm-hmm. and with knowing quite well that the Donbas was integrated in the former Soviet Union economic area. We knew that there would be a conflict, and we never talked about it openly. It was not, there was no interest, actually, in the public opinion. People didn't understand that. But the European Union could have understood it. We all knew, and I think many scholars and journalists and so on and politicians said in those days that Ukraine naturally would be an excellent bridge between the East and the West. Ukraine could have had good relations, economic relations with Russia and with the European Union if we had done it wisely. We could have been a cultural bridge in Ukraine. Ukraine could have been, as an Orthodox and Catholic nation, a cultural bridge between the two. And it could have had an excellent future with a bright economic outlook, actually, if we had been not so pushy and with the intention clearly to take it out of the Russian sphere of influence and to put it in our camp. This has to be seen in context of the 2008 decisions taken in the NATO summit in Bucharest, when then the decision was taken in Bucharest to extend NATO, to offer membership to in NATO to both Ukraine and Georgia, former members of the Soviet Union. And that was a decision that has been taken in the beginning with the opposition of some of the European countries, such as Germany and France, and also smaller ones. And then they changed their mind quite rapidly under American pressure. And then came this West decision, the decision to integrate Ukraine in the West. They should become members of NATO. They should become members of the European Union. And so the conflict with Russia, starting from that moment, intensified. There was already before that, in the 90s and early 2000s, we had already NATO maneuvers on Crimea, in the vicinity there. So the Russians started to be nervous. And we were conscious of this in those days. We knew that. But nevertheless, the Bush administration in those days pushed for that. And so the European Union, which is actually in those days maybe a little less than nowadays, but basically the European Union was already a vassal to the United States in those days. So we adopted in the European Union a policy of integration, of economic integration, of Ukraine, in spite of the Russian interest in that country. So we contributed actively to create a conflict in this area instead of helping Ukraine to be a bridge between East and West.
Wow, your words are powerful, and you say them well. I am so impressed with your ability to explain this in ways that, I'm telling you, What you just explained to us and what you just laid out, and you were a witness to this history. You were there, right? 98% of the people in the West have no clue that this kind of stuff actually took place. To them, the story is all one-sided. I'm really impressed with your passion, with your commitment, and with your explicatory talent to be able to tell us and help us understand this so well. And now I definitely owe you a cup of coffee when you and I find ourselves together in Spief in a couple of weeks. Thank you.
Well, I'm very much looking forward to that cup of coffee, Rick. And as I told you, it's mutual. So I'm looking forward to that. See you in St. Petersburg then.
What a great conversation. What a great interview. Thank you so much. We really appreciate your time. Thanks again.
Thank you for having me. It was a pleasure.
Of course, of course. Well, as usual, as we like to say, all the feedback is appreciated. What did you think of that conversation? I learned some things I'd never known before. I mean, he was there when the Europeans were trying to outmuscle the Russians and try to make sure they could take over Ukraine, so that they can get their military in there and get the economic benefit from the Donbass. And that's all the Russians were saying at the time. The Russians were at the time saying, look, we don't want to take over Ukraine. Ukraine should be an independent, neutral country, but we're not going to let you guys take it over. That's the argument Mr. Putin's made over and over and over again. And he just took us through it, right? He just explained how it happened, why it happened. You know, he was there. Anyway. Let me know what you think. We're on X, we're on Spotify, we're on BitChute, YouTube. I think it's Rick Sanchez Network. Go to Rick Sanchez Network and you'll find me there, and you can even watch different things I do. Anyway, been talking for more than an hour now, so I guess that's it. Thanks so much. Thanks for being with us. And as I always like to say, thanks for letting us into your homes. See you next time.